You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition coming the 14th to the 20th of July 2016. My name is John Elms. I'm joined today by Deputy News Editor John Morgan, reporter Chris Havergal, and Interim Features and Opinions Editor Paul Jump. In our pages this week, the nationwide news that Theresa May is our new Prime Minister has set the tongues wagging in the academy, given her dealings with higher education in the past. John Morgan has been gauging the opinions of leading experts to see whether her ascension to the top job will be a blessing or a curse for the sector. A new study has shown that essay mills are producing high-quality papers which go undetected, leading to speculation that cheating by students could be more prevalent than previously thought. Chris has been finding out more about the murky world. And Paul will be taking us through the feature section, including our cover piece about how the teaching of humanities is changing for millennials. First, John, we have a new PM and she has a history with HE.
That's right, both as Home Secretary and as Shadow Education Secretary. Theresa May has significant previous with universities, and very happily on Monday morning as she emerged as the sole remaining candidate to lead the Conservative Party. I was already at work on a What Theresa May Would Mean for Higher Education piece, and also very happily there had been no material for a What Andrea Leadsom Would Mean for Higher Education piece, so it didn't mean any lost work for me when Ms. Leadsom dropped out. So most notably as Home Secretary, Theresa May has had sort of significant engagement with universities, to put it euphemistically. Yeah. So she was obviously known for pursuing with great alacrity the government's drive to reduce net migration to the tens of thousands, which meant, as universities saw it, restrictions on student visas. And she was once likened to a Dalek by a Vice-Chancellor. And one of her Conservative Party conference speeches saw her say, "I don't care what the university lobbyists say." So there's been a bit of friction. And spoke to Nick Hillman, director of the Higher Education Policy Institute, who used to be special advisor to David Willetts in his time as universities minister. So obviously Nick Hillman came into contact with the Home Office quite a bit. And he said, that he was worried by Theresa May in relation to international students, but equally she's very experienced and she's a very tough negotiator, he said. So given that universities are really focused on the Brexit talks and what they want out of that, that could be a benefit. He also explained that the Home Office under Theresa May was always a bit more like, always gave the impression that it would quite like to treat the Russell Group universities differently, or top third as they saw it, differently in terms of student visas as compared to the rest of universities. So could that be sort of an indication of some of her views? But also spoke to Paul Blomfield, Labour MP, who's a long-standing campaigner on overseas student issues. He said that although she's been unhelpful to universities as Home Secretary, sort of worries about the impact of Brexit, you might provide the opportunity for a fresh start on international issues. And, you know, given the uncertainty over the research income post-Brexit vote, it would be a good idea to start a new approach on migration rules for non-EU students and staff, and particularly taking students out of the net migration count. So we shall see.
Absolutely. But, I mean, you know, most of the potential are, it's a new job, so different perspective, have been caveated with her previous views. Is there more concern or worry from the sector as opposed to our fresh start, would you say?
I think there certainly will be worry, given that she's a figure who has had quite a fractious relationship with universities, but, you know, she has stated that she wants to unite the country as PM, and it's a very different job. So, you know, there's sort of significant opportunities there, I'm sure, for universities to start lobbying anew. And then if you look even further back, we had some views from her on universities when she was Shadow Education Secretary between 1999 and 2001, which is a very long time ago, admittedly. But that time saw her unveil a party pledge aimed at setting our universities free, as she put it, and removing government interference by creating university endowments to fund teaching. And these endowments would have been created by public asset sales. And she spoke to THE back in 2000 and also said that some former polytechnics had lost their way since becoming universities, but that may be too far in the distant past to have any bearing today. Who knows?
It does really show how much things have changed in UK politics and indeed higher education in the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks, that suddenly a Theresa May premiership seems to be sort of the best possible outcome, or at least the least worst outcome for UK universities. Because if you'd have been about 2 or 3 months ago, this would surely have been the outcome that most UK universities, well, a Theresa May premiership would be the outcome that most universities would dread. And suddenly it seems like, you know, the best that they could hope for.
Yeah, probably a reflection of, this Brexit being the top priority all of a sudden post-referendum. And, yeah, as Nick Hillman suggested, I think universities will be, quite pleased that there's someone pragmatic and who's a tough negotiator at the top who would, give them a decent chance of getting what they want from the Brexit talks, which is continued participation in the EU's research programmes.
Yeah, what do we think? Joe Johnson to remain in HE?
It's coming very soon, so by the time this comes out, it'll probably have happened, so probably won't offer any hostages to fortune, but if he did get moved, that might be a bit of a blow for the sort of TEF and HE Bill programme, given that it's very much his personal project.
Yeah. You can find John's story on pages 6 and 7, clearly a space to watch for the future, and we will see whether Theresa May as Prime Minister will start to care about the university lobbyists. Chris, you've been delving into the murky world of essay mills, and cheating by students is proving difficult to catch.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people in higher education have long been aware of essay mills and have probably seen the adverts on the tube, trying to encourage students to use them. But I suspect a lot of universities would have thought, for a starter, not many students probably use them because they weren't sort of detecting huge numbers of it, or that perhaps a reason for that was that the essays weren't very good quality, so that would be a disincentive to students to use them. A new Australian study sort of challenges both of those assumptions. Lisa Lines, who's a history lecturer at the University of New South Wales, conducted a very interesting experiment where she poses a student and ordered essays from 13 ghostwriting websites based around the world. And found that actually, when they were ordered, the quality was, to quote her, sort of higher than expected, to an alarming extent, she finds. I mean, just to give you, an example of some of the undergraduate essays, she ordered 13 undergraduate essays on subject of the Second World War. They cost, in UK currency, although that number is probably rapidly changing, between £95 and £304. So of the 13 essays, 2 failed, but 7 received between 50% and 64%. 3 got between 65% and 74%, and 1 got above 85%. Furthermore, all of these essays were run through Turnitin software, the plagiarism detection software, and that didn't identify anything wrong with them. I mean, one just other thing I should say about the experiment is that it wasn't Dr. Lines who was doing the marking. She actually got some historians from Group of Eight universities in Australia to do the marking, under the impression that they were marking real student essays. So, it does raise, to quote her, reveals a very troubling situation for universities and poses a real threat to academic integrity and standards and public perceptions of these.
Yeah, there were this blows up into, some horrible questions for higher education, because, I suppose reading this as an academic, maybe with the high quality that these essay mills are turning out, is that going to make academics question from different sectors, maybe the UK sector, question about what their students, what if they mark a good one, would their students really valid?
I mean, certainly Lisa Lyons does say that it's probably, you know, and the fact that Turnitin doesn't pick it up does suggest that universities may have to reduce their reliance on essays if they're to sort of maintain that confidence in their marks. She suggests greater use of, you know, exams written under controlled conditions, but also suggests that students could be required to give oral presentations on the topics of essays which they've submitted, something I'm sure which would be perhaps a controversial idea. I mean, there's also perhaps an issue here around educating academics better to be able to pick these up, because she does say in the study which is published in Teaching in Higher Education that academics who would really know the sort of the telltale signs to look out for may have been able to pick things up. I mean, for example, some of them used American English when they were meant to use British English. And if you actually got the Word document or the digital document, whichever software was used, often it was the ghostwriter's name who appeared as the author rather than the actual student, which seems like a sort of a bit of a, you know, a schoolboy error, as it were. But it would appear that, well, I mean, especially if you printed out, you know, that's something that can be got around. So, you know, she does say that where students take precautions against being caught, basically if they're savvy, this cheating is, to quote her, virtually undetectable.
Absolutely. Something that I'm sure the higher education sector will keep, in the UK will keep tabs on very much, and that's alluded to in Chris's story, which can also be found on pages 6 and 7. Paul, you're going to take us through our cover feature on 21st century humanities teaching.
I am. Well, if all this plagiarism concerns is another reason to think that the essays had its day, then we could have the solution here. Yeah. The cover features, it's a sort of double header by a couple of people at Brunel University, one of whom is very well known, Will Self, the novelist and cultural commentator. And he writes about current humanities teaching as being skeuomorphic. Now, this being Will Self, of course, he had to use a big word that nobody would understand for that. But
use a few, well, actually.
It turns out that a skeuomorph is a sort of the use of a sort of old-fashioned form in a sort of slightly antiquated way, such as the image of an old-fashioned telephone on your digital phone when you want to make a call. Obviously, that doesn't have any functional relevance anymore. And he sort of sees a lot of humanities teaching really in those terms. You know, there's an element of submitting things digitally and all the rest of it, but, you know, essentially it's still about, you know, writing essays, the kind of thinking that goes into writing essays, and to some extent memorising stuff that's now instantly accessible on Wikipedia or any number of other websites. So, you know, he sort of sets up the issue, really, that this is what the issue is. And then his colleague at Brunel, William Watkin, has actually, you know, arguably got some of the solutions to this. He's just started a new course on violence in all its political and religious and sexual forms. And he's very much taken a sort of digital approach. So instead of, although this is an English literature course, he's very much taken the idea of text very, very broadly. It includes films, tweets, and even wolf whistles apparently can be text. Digital ones, presumably. And, you know, they've looked at all kinds of things, including some of the decapitation videos that ISIS have produced, although at least stills from them, because they weren't exactly sure about the legality of actually watching them. But they did go through some of the stills. But I guess it's the sort of way, well, two elements to it really. One is the way it was taught. Some of the teaching involved William Watkins sort of writing blogs. You know, that sort of doing it through the digital realm. He also mentions that he does a zombie walk to introduce a discussion of the ontological issues surrounding the undead. There was also a bit of moonwalking from Michael Jackson's Thriller video. So there's sort of crowd-pleasing elements, I suppose, to that. But it also sort of recognition that all these cultural things can be taxed. But in the assessment of it, rather than getting them to write an essay, he decided that given the content and the way it was taught, it was better to let them do it in a digital way. So essentially they wrote their own blog pieces, which he says didn't just involve them writing a standard essay and then sticking it on their blog. He thinks that they wrote pieces that sort of somewhere between standard academic speak and the way normal people speak.
Right.
And I guess perhaps the key point is that he thinks they all really excelled in this because this was very much in their realm as millennials. So they pretty much all got firsts. They're all now working to put all these together into some kind of digital magazine. So he thinks it's been a sort of great success. I should say Will Self was also involved on teaching on this course, but it was Watkin was the sort of course overseer.
Sure. Sure, and so I mean, you know, what's their end point for this? That they've, you know, it's featured in the magazine, and it's quite interesting, and some would say radical. But you know, would it be taken on board by the higher education sector? What do we think?
Well, yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? I mean, this is obviously sort of specific to humanity. Yeah. Obviously, it's not relevant really to the sciences, but you know. Digital natives, clearly, you know, academic speak is about as far from the kind of social media speak that they're used to as you could possibly get, and you could argue that the strain of that will increasingly be felt. I don't know, what does everyone else think?
Well, I mean, certainly I know I've written in recent months about students who are asked to edit Wikipedia entries as a means of assessment rather than writing an essay. I mean, clearly we've heard today about some of the problems around academic essays. And, you know, exams could be argued, you know, are equally problematic for students of that generation. You know, it's probably the only time that they ever write longhand, you know, to any great, you know, extent for several hours. Yeah. Certainly when I was at university some time ago, that applied to me. So I'm sure people will be looking for alternatives, whether this is the right one, whether the sector settles on an alternative or several alternatives probably remains to be seen.
Yeah. Could remove the market for essay mills as well, potentially. No essays.
Well, a blog mill.
Blog mills.
Blog mills. Yes, really.
Do they write magazine articles?
Aren't we getting into a realm where we're, you know, academics maybe kowtowing to what students want, how students want to be assessed? As opposed to how they should be assessed, because I've spoken to people who said to assume that students even now, who are in their first year of university, are digital natives is stupid. They still want to be taught in a way that they're expecting of university. Some people will think that the digital native will not actually materialise for maybe another generation.
Yeah, and it's also the case that digital native perhaps assumes that your students are probably 18 years old, yeah, or at least sort of under 30, and probably assumes they're from a Western upbringing, and potentially one that is, if not affluent, you know, at least has access to digital technology during their upbringing. So, yeah, certainly problems there.
You know, part of this relates, of course, to the question of what higher education is for. What exactly are you preparing students to do? To be academics, to function in the workplace, somewhere in between, you know.
Yes. Quickly, though, Paul, our second feature, I did want to pick this up because it was a very interesting. I mean, the whole feature section this week was replete, and it had some great stuff. Randy Malamud has, apologies if that's not how you pronounce your name, has written a really interesting piece about dreariness, tedium, yawns. That's just the headline. But what's he been writing about?
Well, he's writing about boredom, really, and in a sort of slightly postmodern sense, in that he's been to a conference about boredom, and obviously the joke is that most academic conferences, you know, boredom is a big element of them, even if it's not strictly speaking on the agenda. But it has a bit of fun with that idea. But it also talks more seriously about the idea that academics should just get beyond you know, yet another, you know, deconstruction of Jane Austen or Shakespeare, and start to, you know, start to really plough different furrows and look at different topics. He thinks this makes them, you know, more creative and more interesting as academics.
Absolutely. Well, the feature section begins on page 32 of our magazine, and I thoroughly recommend reading all three pieces. They're fascinating if you get your head around Will Self's language, which I sometimes struggle to do. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for in this week's issue review, but as always, complete coverage of the latest HE news, features and books, of course, can be found in our magazine and on our website. If you'd like to make a comment on any of the issues discussed in this podcast, or indeed any of the contents of this week's editions, you can find us on all manner of social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course our website, timeshighereducation.com. Alternatively, if you wish to, you can drop us an email at the.letters@tesglobal.com. Please do get in touch, we'd love to hear from you. Until next week's issue review, however, I wish you goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.